Welcome to 2013. I'm Spider Robinson, and this is Spider on the Web number 93. And although Christmas is now in our rearview mirror, I just now got both permission and the time to podcast some of the best Christmas music ever for you, and I never was a stickler for dates. Regular listeners to this podcast will know that I have a sort of ongoing pact with them. For years now, this has been one place you could come at any time during November or December without hearing as much as a goddamn note of Christmas music. But now that the din of jingles and snow bells and elves has faded away in the rest of the world, I feel safe in springing at least a little on you, and I really think you're going to like it. First of all, here is my new favorite Christmas song of all time, simultaneously the most rational and the most moving Christmas song I've ever heard. A Christmas song that's way smart with lots of heart, and one I predict will be sung by thousands of intelligent voices with wet faces for hundreds of years to come. It is performed here now by its creator, one of my favorite living songwriters, the great Tim Minchin. We join him in concert at the O2 in London, as he has just announced that this will be the last number of the evening, and a few twits have gotten up from their seats to beat the rush, and he is forgiving them. Christmas spirit. Take it, Tim.
I don't always get to do it, and I respect those people. I respect the going to the cars. I respect it. I respect you. You can listen to this one on the radio. Fuck it. Go. Totally. I'd be one of you guys. I wouldn't have made it this far. For jewels, I would have.
I'm looking forward to Christmas. It's sentimental, I know, but I just really like it. I am hardly religious. I'd rather break bread with Dawkins than Desmond Tutu, to be honest. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to consumerism, to the commercialization of an ancient religion, to the westernization of a dead Palestinian press ganged into selling PlayStations and beer. But I still really like it. I'm looking forward to Christmas, though I'm not expecting a visit from Jesus. I'll be seeing my dad, brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I don't go in for ancient wisdom. I don't believe just 'cause ideas are tenacious, it means that they're worthy. I get freaked out by churches. Some of the hymns that they sing have nice chords, but the lyrics are dodgy. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to the miseducation of children who in tax-exempt institutions are taught to externalize blame and to feel ashamed and to judge things as plain right or wrong. But I quite like the songs. I'm not expecting big presents. The old combination of socks, jocks, and chocolates is just fine by me. 'Cause I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I'll be seeing my dad. my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. And you, my baby girl, my jet-lagged infant daughter, you'll be handed round the room like a puppy at a primary school, and you won't understand. But you will learn someday that wherever you are and whatever you face, these are the people who make you feel safe in this world, my sweet blue-eyed girl. And if my baby girl, when you're 21 or 31 and Christmas comes around, and you find yourself 9,000 miles from home, you'll know whatever comes. Your brothers and sisters and me and your mum will be waiting for you in the sun when Christmas comes. Your brothers and sisters, your aunts and your uncles, your grandparents, cousins, and me and your mom will be waiting for you in the sun, drinking white wine in the sun. Darling, whenever you come, we'll be waiting for you in the sun, drinking white wine in the sun, waiting for you in the sun, waiting. I really like Christmas. It's sentimental, I know.
Thank you very much. This has been an extraordinary night. Thank you. Get them up, get them up. How do you make them stand up? There, yeah, like that. An incredible, incredible privilege that I never thought I'd have to play with people like this. Please thank them. And Jules is all right too.
White Wine in the Sun, and it is the closing track of the brilliant double CD Live at the O2. Because we recently became cyber pen pals, next podcast I hope to be able to play you a few tracks from the soundtrack album of Tim's latest artistic triumph, namely writing all the songs for the musical version of Roald Dahl's Matilda, which just won an unprecedented 7 Oliviers in its London production and is just about to open on Broadway. I think Tim is the smartest and, when he wants to be, the funniest songwriter working today. Since I now have his kind permission to podcast a track or two of his work, here is the song that originally made him a breakout star at Edinburgh, one of the most relentlessly honest and hilarious self-examinations in rock and roll history.
He doesn't have a problem with drugs. He just doesn't get them. He's fine that his mates have tattoos, but he thinks they'll regret them. He likes going to pubs, but he hates it when the music's too loud. He tends not to go to rock concerts because he can't stand the crowd. But all he's ever wanted to be is a rock star on Rage or MTV.
but he knows that it's not fucking likely. He just turned 30. He knows that he will always be a rock and roll nerd. He'll keep writing songs the world will never hear, and though they won't be heard, he'll just keep writing. Oh yeah. But you see, the problem is he always dreamt of being a star, but he learned piano instead of guitar, which in the 90s didn't get you very far. So while the other kids were learning Stairway, he was the piano to their forte. But he was convinced one day he'd rock their fucking asses, be an icon for the disenfranchised masses, grow his hair long and rebel against the state. But just for now, that'd have to wait, 'cause he's running late for his morning classes, and he will always be a rock and roll nerd. He'll keep playing gigs that no one knows about, and though it sounds absurd, he'll just keep playing. Oh yeah. But you see, the problem is there's not much depth in what he's singing. He's a victim of his upper middle class upbringing, so he can't write about the hood or bling bling. So he sits and imagines his girlfriend is dead, to try and evoke some angst in his middle class head. But the bitch is always fine at 9:30 when they go to bed, and he's not spent a single night in prison. He has no issues with nutrition. He has no drinking problem and no drug addiction, unless you count the drugs they put in chicken. And marijuana always tends to make him cough. He doesn't look good with his t-shirt off, and when he tries to act tough, you can tell he's tricking. Go out late, a puff and pills and having fun. He goes home and showers and gets a good 8 hours. He gets thrills from his morning run. And while his mates all go on dates, are taking speed and drinking cans of Jim Beam, he stays home and cooks, calls up with a book with the girl he's had since he was 17. 'Cause he's never really been part of the scene. Give him Guns and Roses, he'll take Queen. He's more into Beatles than the Stones. He's more of Stevie Wonder than Ramones. And he's never owned a panel van. He never shot a Pantera van. He doesn't know the difference between metal and thrash. He couldn't tell you nothing about Axl and Slash. He likes Ben Folds and the Jackson 5. He knows all the words to Stayin' Alive. And though he wants to feel grungy and cool, he spent 11 years at a private school. So it don't matter how he tries, he cannot hide behind his rock and roll lies. 'Cause you've either got it or you don't. Yeah, you'll either rock it or you won't. He knows that his music lacks depth, but it just can't be helped. He has nothing interesting to say, so he writes about himself. But he doesn't want to seem self-obsessed, so he writes in third person. In an attempt to seem more rock and roll, but he suspects it's not working. And deep in his heart he knows that he'll never be Silverchair or Eskimo Joe. And even if he was quite pretty with small pants like Kylie, he knows that he will always be a rock and roll nerd. He'll keep writing songs the world don't care about, and though it sounds absurd, he'll just keep writing. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You can criticize him, but he won't care, 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 'cause he wants to rock, and he will never be deterred. But he'll always be a fucked up little try-hard one.
Tim Minchin. Tim Minchin!
There's no smooth way to cut that. The applause continues at that volume for quite some time. Still does, actually. A few more tracks of music, and I will play you some more of The Free Lunch, my newest audiobook from Blackstone Audio. But first, here's one more piece of Christmas music good enough to hear in July, an excerpt from a new Christmas CD by the Krieber family of Horseshoe Bay. A million years ago, Mike Krieber produced my own CD, Belaboring the Obvious, with Danny Cassavant, and played piano throughout. He was with the Irish Rovers for many years, was one of K.D. Lang's Reclines for 4 years, and co-wrote and produced several of Raffi's albums, including Bananaphone, which won a Juno and was a Grammy finalist. I often write while listening to one of his own instrumental CDs, Dancers of the Spheres, which Jeannie also adored. He is joined here by his wife Monique and daughter Michelle and a few friends. Here's a track from Michelle's new solo CD, Timeless, Songs of a Century. It may sound a bit familiar.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun, and I say, say it's been here. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right. Little darling, the smile's returning to their faces. Little darling, it seems like years since it's been here.
Play some more of Michelle later if there's room. But just in case there's not, there's one pertinent fact in her biography I should perhaps mention. In the province of British Columbia, where she makes her home, it will be 6 more years before Michelle Krieber can legally buy a beer. She is 13 years old. Can you imagine when she gets some experience behind her? But now it's time to get some good old sinus friction up in here. Last time I read you the first 2 chapters of my novel, The Free Lunch. I'll give you chapter 3 now, then a bit more music to rest your brain, and then chapter 4, and after that we'll see what's what, and I'll give you whatever there's time for. Remember that if your curiosity to know what happens next should prove irresistible, you can always go order the audiobook from the usual sources, or by going directly to blackstoneaudio.com. Here now is chapter 3. Of The Free Lunch by Spider Robinson. Chapter 3. Soaking. Rather to his surprise, he was asleep nearly at once. And then even more quickly he was awake again, wide awake, instantly aware of who and where he was, motionless in bed, reaching out with all his senses for whatever it was that had wakened him. He couldn't identify it. But neither could he escape the conviction that something was, well, not wrong exactly. Annie was sleeping soundly beside him, so probably nothing could be seriously wrong. But something was definitely different, happening. Was there a sound in the air, behind or beneath the sound of Annie's breathing, a kind of hum? The harder he tried to answer the question, the more uncertain he became. Was there some unfamiliar smell in the room? Again he was unsure. Was whatever it was coming more from one direction than another? Impossible to say. The more negative reports came in from his senses, the more convinced he became that something was happening somewhere. He knew the sensible thing was to roll over and go back to sleep. Even if he could figure out what was going on, and even if he concluded something needed to be done about it, he wouldn't be able to do it. His hostess mentor, whom he did not want to piss off, was asleep next to him. He was exhausted himself and sensed he had a big day ahead of him tomorrow. heart pounding, he slipped from the bed, so stealthily that Annie's breathing never changed. He had no idea what kind of signal he was picking up, but perhaps if he moved his detectors around, he could triangulate on the thing. He paused for a moment, closed his eyes, and set out across the dark room. The nameless event did seem to change in some way as he moved, but it did so almost at random so that the information he gained still refused to collapse into any kind of useful pattern. He changed direction a couple of times to no avail. "Your diet must be about 50-50 carrots and loco weed," Annie said softly. He froze. "I can't figure out what in the name of God's labia majora you think you're doing, but I'm impressed by how well you're doing it in the dark. You must have eyes like a cat." "Actually, I've got my eyes closed," he said. "I looked around before when the light was on." "You look around a room once and you can navigate it in pitch dark?"
Yeah, I guess. Sorry I woke you."
"What the hell were you doing, practicing square dance?"
I thought I heard something. Or something."
"Oh." She sat up. "I see. Interesting. I think I'm starting to understand."
"What?"
"Why I picked you."
"Picked me for what?"
"To be my friend." He was startled, speechless. "You're sensitive to the place," she said. "I must have known it somehow. Thank God, I was beginning to think I was nuts." She got up from the bed. He heard her start to get dressed. "Throw your pants on," she said. "We're going for a walk." He closed his eyes and retraced his steps. His clothes were folded and stacked on a night table on his side of the bed. He was ready before Annie had finished strapping her command band on her wrist and beeping the door lock open. She did not bother to turn on a light since neither of them needed one. He followed the whisper of her clothes through the dark. He had expected light in the corridor, but had assumed for some reason that it would be damped down to night level. It was daytime bright. He ducked and flinched, then hurried after her, blinking furiously. Shortly they came to a service elevator. He made a mark on the map he had been making in his head on the way, and without thinking about it, also created and stored a mirror-reversed copy of that map, so that if something went wrong and they had to come back out of that elevator at a dead run, he wouldn't have to waste half a second doing it then. Annie consulted the command band on her wrist, put her ear to the elevator door, and only then pushed the button. He filed that, too. The car arrived quickly, and he followed her in. "Elevator top level," she told it. "Lights out." The car darkened, and they went up. Slowly at first, but soon fast. Just as he began fumbling around for a handhold, he realized he didn't need it anymore. They were there. The moment the door opened, he knew where they were. The uppermost reach of Johnny's tree. Its magic was not functioning at the moment. He could still see Annie, for instance, and the nets that caught you if you fell were also visible now, or nearly, gleaming translucently in the moonlight. But the spot was unmistakable. All of Strawberry Fields was laid out 30 or 40 meters below them. In the distance you could make out the Bridge of Birds, and beyond that a little of Rogero's castle, the hippogriff asleep atop it now. It was one of Mike's favorite vantage points in Dreamworld, and only partly because during the day it conferred invisibility on all who came here. "No one I think is in my tree," Johnny had said in the song for which this part of Dreamworld was named. Annie paused before leaving the elevator, so he did too. He assumed she was scanning for possible observers either up here or down on the ground with her eyes or ears or, for all he knew, nose. But he was wrong. "I'm rushing this," she said. "Elevator hold." She sounded irritated. He looked closer, squinting in the poor light, and she looked irritated, too.
"What's the matter?"
She hesitated. "Do you believe in magic?" she asked suddenly. He blinked.
"Of course."
She looked even more annoyed. "Let me try again. Do you believe the magic in Dreamworld is real, capital M magic, or is it stage magic? Do you even understand the difference?"
"Of course I do. Jesus, Annie, I'm not a little kid."
She seemed less annoyed.
"Then answer me. Is this place infested with genuine fairies and unicorns, or do they do it with mirrors?"
Mike took a long time answering. This was not a trivial question. In a sense, he was being asked whether he believed in Dreamworld.
A thousand movies and TV shows and books and comics urged him to punch his fist in the air and shout yes in reflex response to dutifully support the myth, in the same way that grown-ups would not publicly admit to the non-existence of Santa Claus. If this had been daytime, and there had existed even the remote possibility that another child or even grown-up might be within earshot, he would have followed that instinct unhesitatingly. But this was not daytime, and they were not in public. The question had been privately asked. He sensed somehow that Annie wanted the most honest answer he could give. All right, then, what answer was that? More time ticked by. She waited, her face impassive. "It's faked," he said at last. She nodded solemnly. "That's okay, though," he said. "I mean, well, it's not really fake, exactly. Not like cheating. They'd use real magic if they could. They want there to be real magic, lots of it, so they make some and give it to us so we can carry a little bit home with us to help us recognize it." He felt himself running on and stopped. "I mean, they're not cheats." "Relax, I know what you mean. So you understand it's all basically a magic act, tricks and gimmicks." "Best ones on Earth," he said. "Did you ever go backstage and ask a magician how a trick worked?" He nodded. "Did he tell you?" He nodded again. "Okay, here's the important part. How did you feel once you knew? I mean, did it spoil the trick knowing how he did it?" The question seemed so odd he dug out the memory involved and replayed it, just to be sure. "No," he said, "not at all. It was more fun knowing how. I mean, it was even more amazing that he could do something magical like that without magic." She relaxed. "Good. Annie, what are you asking me all this weird stuff for?" She sighed. "Because it finally dawned on me that I can't keep you under for any length of time without teaching you the secrets of Dreamworld. Most of them, anyway. And a lot of people, well, no matter how much they think they want to know how the magic is done, deep down inside they'd really rather not know. I didn't want to be responsible for spoiling Dreamworld for you." He thought that over. "Well, thanks, but I don't think there's anything I'd rather not know." He frowned. "I hate not knowing stuff." She raised an eyebrow. "You are a rare one. Let's go, then." They left the elevator. Everything was at once familiar and weirdly unfamiliar. He had been here at least a dozen times in daylight. It was strange and mildly thrilling to be here at night. The insubstantial sensation of something happening was back in force, intensified almost to the point of making sense. He realized that in his previous visits he had never noticed a second elevator. He glanced over his shoulder and failed to find it. "How do I get back into that elevator if I need to?" he asked. "You follow me. If I'm not around, you're S.O.L. She saw he did not know the idiom. "Well, let's just say you're gully low. Don't worry about it. We'll get you a command band of your own tomorrow. Take a seat." She had led them to a crotch in Johnny's tree that happened to be his particular favorite since it gave the best view of Penny Lane. Beneath them the tree, powered down or not, silently extruded gossamer safety nets. They sat together side by side. He gazed around at strawberry fields below, only half seeing it. It was all true. He was really, finally backstage, after hours. 30 meters up in the air, he was under. All Dreamworld was his. The night was electric. It was too dark to make out much of the meadow below in moonlight. He lifted his gaze up past Penny Lane to the forest that blocked off sight of the rest of Dreamworld, save for the distant arch of the Bridge of Birds, and then higher to the night sky. His gaze insisted on yanking itself back downward again. There was something strange about Penny Lane. It was... holy shit, it was shimmering. Vibrating just perceptibly in the darkness. Not all of it, but most of it. He seemed to see a droplet of some kind fall from the pretty nurse's poppy tray to the sidewalk, and then another. He leaned out as far as the barrier would let him, looked straight down at the meadow beneath his branch, and squinted hard. A scrap of cloud drifted away from the moon to help, and he cried out in spite of himself. Strawberry Fields was crawling. All of Dreamworld was crawling. He marinated in horror for perhaps 10 seconds of objective time. Is that less than 1,000,000 years? Afterward, maybe. Then Annie pulled him back up into the tree crotch, squinted at his face, cursed, and slapped him hard. It was like a cold reboot of his brain. This computer may not have been shut down properly the last time it was used. You should always shut down using the power key. Next time I will, I promise. Now, what was it that made us crash again? Oh, something to get hung about, indeed. Annie was shaking him. How old were you when you saw it? She was saying. Her question might have been obscure to another, but he understood it without thought and answered at once. 8. Shit, she said with feeling. Then, an animal? Or a cat? My cat Smokey. I found him 2 days after. She clenched her jaw and nodded. I should have thought. I'm sorry. Mike, look at me. Stop trying to look over the side and look me in the eye. He did as he was told. Listen hard. There is nothing dead down there. There is nothing ugly down there. Nothing creepy, I promise. What is down there is good. It's magic, but it's white magic. It's part of what makes Dream World possible. Do you understand? She saw his expression and with an effort made herself speak softer and more slowly. Let me try again. Have you ever loved somebody, Mike? I mean, really loved them. He thought hard. Smokey. She seemed to wince for some reason, but pressed on. Okay, did you ever see Smokey shit while there wasn't anyone else around to see you look? He was startled into paying closer attention. She asked the oddest questions. Sure. Was it ugly? Huh? Everybody says shitting is gross, creepy, ugly. You hide in a closet to do it so nobody will see. Was Smokey ugly when he was shitting? No, he pictured it. Actually, it was kind of beautiful, if you want to know the truth. I wish I could see him do it now. She nodded. Then you understand. Everybody says shitting is creepy, but if it's somebody you love doing it, it's beautiful to watch. It's a part of them, so it's a gift. So then, do you see, shitting isn't creepy. It's just that everybody doesn't love everybody. Enough. Let me think about that a minute, he said. She did, waiting patiently in her cross-legged tailor's seat. After a while, he said, tell me if I've got this right. Stuff everybody thinks is creepy might not be creepy if there's enough love around. A full-bore smile flashed and was gone, the first of hers he had ever seen, and now he knew what she had looked like at his age. Gold star. He nodded, took a deep breath, and leaned over the side again. He saw nearly at once this time that they didn't really look a whole lot like maggots at all, really. Not if you looked closely. For one thing, the countless trillions of swarming grains of rice below were not the pale yellow color his memory had imposed on them. Those near enough to a maintenance light to be seen clearly were all, he saw now, a soft pastel blue. His reptile brain relaxed a bit. Almost nothing that lives is that color, and nothing dangerous. At this distance, they must all actually be much bigger than grains of rice. He guessed them at the size of a thumb. They were not all the same size, either, just most of them. And they were not, in fact, swarming, technically. Not with the blind, mindless randomness of maggots. They were clearly all moving purposefully, each toward a destination of its own. Some were encumbered with things too small or shadowed to make out, either portaged on their backs or dragged behind them. In one spot, he saw over 2 dozen of them cooperating to drag away something bulky. Someone's lost camcorder. Now he understood. They're cleaning Penny Lane. Annie's voice was serene behind him now. Cleaning, disinfecting, polishing, resetting, reconfiguring, repairing, restocking, repainting, maintaining. They're healing it, Mike. Healing the damage people did to it without meaning to, without being able to help it. They do it every night. It's happening all over Dreamworld right now. Robots, minibots, microbots, even nanobots, all working in harmony. Billions of them. I like to come up here or a few other places and watch them. Everything else in the universe falls apart. But Thomas Amiga doesn't allow entropy in here. Those robots down there keep it out. He watched them for a timeless time. They're not creepy at all, he said at last. They're beautiful. Yes. He sat upright on the limb again. I thought it was like an army of people that fixed everything up again at night. She nodded. The management do contrive to give that impression to the public without ever exactly saying so. Some civilians who didn't know better might think little robot maggots were creepy, you know. There is a small army working here right now underground. Techs and engineers and set designers who forgot to go home and so on. But they're mostly not allowed up on the set. You can't trust them not to spill a cup of coffee or forget a power tool. Annie, the people that work here in the daytime, are they real? He felt himself blushing. Not the cousins, I mean. I know they're real. But like the elves and trolls and leprechauns and, you know, the... He hesitated. All the little people and the big ones that are magical, like Master Lee. Are they real? She grinned, not as good as her earlier smile, but now he knew what she'd looked like at 25. Ah, you want to learn all the secrets your first night, are you sure? Well, as any child of four knew, if a Dreamworld character chose to touch you, the mother thing, say, or one of the little people, they certainly seemed to be real enough. But if you touched one of them without invitation, as often as not, they were liable to vanish like a burst soap bubble. It was one of the primary mysteries of Dreamworld, a subject of endless speculation, one of the principal evidences that magic lived here. Yeah. About 50-50, she said. He did some mental calculation and was stunned. God, there must be a significant fraction of the little people in North America work here, she said, and more from other places. Thomas Amiga is our patron saint. You must have seen the size of the employee parking zone. Well, yeah, but how can you tell how many of those people wear overalls and how many put on costumes when they get inside? Good point. No, the day shift is only about 20% staff, 20% cousins. The rest are all cast. Wow. To have the knowledge felt peculiar, as if someone had given him the address of Santa's summer home. His mind skittered away. I saw somebody die today. The non sequitur did not throw her. Tell me about it, was all she said. So he did. She asked a lot of questions, and he ended up remembering it better than he thought he had, coming up with all sorts of details of what he'd seen, what he'd heard, what he'd felt. He decided he liked telling stuff to Annie. In the first place, there was a heady quality to sitting in a forbidden place at night discussing death with an adult. This was Mike's very first bull session. And in the second place, there was something about the way Annie listened that he liked. Grown-ups rarely listened to you. They mostly just paused between their own speeches to make sure you'd admired the last one. She heard what he said. You could tell from her questions. I think the cousin was right, she said when he was done. About her being lucky? Sure. Boy, to die in Dreamworld? A little less than 50 people have been that lucky since they opened the doors, and by God, I intend to be one of them. But it must be a special grace to go during Firefall. For some reason, I wish I knew her name, Mike said. Is there a way I could find out without taking a chance? Her name was Judith Grossman, Annie said. She was a poet from New York, and she is survived by 2 daughters and 4 grandchildren. You already knew about her? I know everything that happens in Dreamworld. I just wanted to know about her passing, how it was. Well, I don't see how it could have been much better. They say the ones God loves most are the ones who die making love, she said, but I agree her passing was almost as good. It doesn't even surprise me anymore. What doesn't? She sighed. Mike, I think of myself as a hard-headed realist. You have to be to live in a dream world. But there's a statistical anomaly that almost tempts me to mysticism. Of the 46 people I mentioned before that have died here, 35 went with, as near as I can find out, an absolute minimum of pain or fear. If it was an accident that got them, they never knew what hit them. The sick ones mostly seemed to either fall down on something soft or fail to get up from a comfortable seat. Half of them died actually smiling. And of the 11 exceptions, well, at least 7 of them had it coming. They were either engaged in trying to hurt someone else or had hurt someone badly outside and come in to hide. I saw 3 of those happen myself and saw convincing evidence for the other 7. The other 4, nobody knows what happened. I cling to those 4 exceptions. Why? Because if I ever have to concede that a benign, invisible spirit is in fact watching over Dreamworld, it'll spoil the place for me. I might even have to leave. Huh? That'd make me want to stay. I understand. But I look at it this way. If there's a magic force that can help the good die happy and punish the wicked, and it's only got time to cover 1 amusement park, I don't think I want to have anything to do with it. I'll go take my chances on the outside with the other peasants. Mike wondered if he were that noble. Well, he could admire it anyway.
I see what you mean. Do you think you can get to sleep now? He asked his body. Yeah. Then let's go. He noticed that she rose slowly from her tailor's seat and realized she was exhausted. He pondered what, if anything, to say about that, and in the elevator came up with, Annie? Thanks, I know I'm a pain. She sighed theatrically. Up all night with the baby at my age. Seeing his expression, she sobered. Don't worry about it, Mike. I'm glad you came. I hate like hell to admit it, and I'm not even sure I believe it, but this place was just beginning to get the tiniest bit dull. She gifted him with another of those quick smiles. I needed to see it again through your eyes. She did an instant 180 and became stern. Now go to bed. He didn't know what to say, so he said nothing. But once they got back home, he fell asleep with a warm feeling. That's a good place to pause for a music break. Here's another track by the daughter of a friend. Gina Spasto is the daughter of Jim Spasto, who co-authored the Stardance screenplay with Jeannie and the great David Gerald. I've never met Gina, and I have no idea how old she is. All I can tell you is, here's a track of hers, a song of striking power and simplicity called Southern California Green.
Well, the priest, he ruined that song for me in a way you might have laughed to see. And you are done. And the whole time he talked down to us, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And
Spasto's remarkable music, visit https://soundcloud.com/greedykidney. That's GREEDY-KIDNEY. I recommend her stuff very highly. Here's a track so new the album it will appear on has not yet been envisioned, a rough mix of the newest song by my dear friend Doug Cox of Cumberland, B.C. Take it away, Doug. Song with which all too many of us can identify. Doug will be familiar to regular listeners of this podcast and should be to anyone with ears. For a real good time, check out his website, www.dougcox.org. You won't believe the size of his discography. Add /listen/ to that URL and you can download some very tasty freebies indeed. Now, before I return you to the free lunch again, here's a splendid track by Marcus Eaton, backed by the great James Raymond, who plays keyboards for Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and happens to be David Crosby's boy. If you like the track, you can find a video of it on YouTube with very little search. It's called Sight and Song, and it contains some of the best musicianship I've heard this year. Okay, or last year either.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
You and I, two cars passing in the middle of the night, headlights reaching through the haze, to grasp each other before we gain full sight, illuminated face, as you round the curve, rest of you's in darkness, I begin to swerve, road has so many twists and turns. Would you come along? A smile could be your favorite sight. Heartbeat, my favorite song. twists and turns. Would you come along? Smile could be your favorite sight. Every molecule says you're the fire and I'm the fuel. All the planets in the cosmos and the stars clearly show us what could all be ours. Would you like to come along? Heartbeat could be my favorite song. You and I, two cars passing in the middle of the night, reaching through the haze to grasp each other before we gain full sight. Illuminated face as you round the curve, rest of you's in darkness. I begin to swerve. Road has so many twists and turns. Would you come along? Smile could be your favorite sight. Heart beats my favorite. Your heart beats my favorite
Hell yeah. And now here's chapter 4 of The Free Lunch by Spider Robinson.
Chapter 4. Meanwhile, in Mordor. At about the same time, at the top of a tall tower a few thousand kilometers away, a morbidly obese man named Alonzo Haynes glared at his state-of-the-art executive desk and told himself for the umpteenth time that the electronic office sucked. He was old enough and cranky enough, especially at this hour, to remember with fondness the days when people came to your office in corpus all the time. It was much easier to bully a live human being than any electronic avatar. A forceful personality does not digitize well. You can let your email sit there in the box all day before acknowledging its existence, but the email doesn't know you're keeping it waiting. You can't discomfit a voicemail message by interrupting it or letting uncomfortable silences follow statements you don't like. You can't project menace properly over even the best vidphone. Oh, there were tricks for dominating even at such removes, and Haynes had mastered them all, but they just weren't as intrinsically satisfying as seeing the other son of a bitch squirm on the far side of your desk, having him physically on your turf, smelling his discomfiture. Worst of all, the electronic gadgets were so damnably simple to use now, there was no real publicly admissible reason to have a personal secretary anymore. There was nobody around the office to intimidate during the day but his three executive assistants, and they just weren't expendable enough for him to risk a good workout. Ah, but tonight, at 2 o'clock in the morning, there was hope. He watched it approaching on the security monitor on his desktop. Randall Conway, entering the empty office tower on schedule, not by way of the lobby, and without coming to the attention of any of the tower's security personnel still on duty at this hour, just as Haynes himself had entered 10 minutes ago. As fit as Haynes was fat, he moved with the graceful efficiency of a successful predator, which he was. This might go either way. There were two possible outcomes, both good. If Conway had called this late-night meeting to report failure, then humiliating him would be not only prudent, but just. If not, if he actually had something, then he would be too valuable to offend without good reason, like the executive assistants. But on the bright side, Haynes' most cherished dreams would be about to come true. It was a win-win situation, really. He began to cheer up, or at least sulk less emphatically, as he always did at such times. He studied Conway's face as the man rode up in the special elevator, a longish ride even at modern acceleration, but found no clues. Well, a perfect poker face was part of what Haynes was paying him for. And after all, Conway probably knew, certainly must suspect, that his employer was watching him as he ascended to the penthouse Erie. To wear a poker face was an admission of discomfort. Or might have been if Conway's face hadn't looked like that all the time. Haynes hated having to deal with Conway, for the man was almost as smart as he was and just as murderous. But he had no choice. He needed someone like Conway, and Conway was the best someone like him there was, Haynes' best and only hope of destroying the despised Philip Avery and all his works. He loathed Avery far more than he did Conway, perhaps more than anyone alive loathed anyone. Elisha Gray might have known such hatred in his day, the man who filed his patent application for the telephone an hour and a half after Alexander Graham Bell. Except that Haynes was even more aggrieved because he, goddammit, had been first. Thrill World, the violent fantasy-based theme park into which he had poured several fortunes, only one of them his own, committing himself irretrievably for life, had opened its doors to the world exactly 4 weeks before Thomas Amiga and his dog Avery had opened up their damned dream world. Just as the elevator began decelerating, Haynes realized with a start that he had forgotten to disable the office's recording gear, and hastily did so, wiping the last 10 minutes for good measure. If Conway had succeeded, there must be no record of this conversation. And if he had failed and was here for a reaming, Haynes could always turn the cameras back on. The elevator opened, and Conway emerged like a panther from a cage. "I want a chair," he said at once in that horridly husky voice. Haynes could not be flustered by any serve, but this came close. He hated it when he had failed to think something through. "Of course," he said. There actually was a visitor's chair in the room, shoved well back out of the way, and he managed to find the button that would summon it to the proper position. Conway curled up in it without thanks.
"We secure?" he rasped.
"We're not here," Haynes agreed.
"I've got them," Conway said without further preamble. "I don't know exactly what I've got yet, but I know I've got them."
Haynes began the laborious task of preparing himself to be happy. Smiling, an otherwise useless grimace, sometimes helped, so he tried it.
"Tell me about it. Did you find the mother elf?" "I found out she really exists, yes, but I don't know where or what she looks like, and it's not important."
Haynes was surprised. He'd been sure the mother elf was bullshit, folk myth. But,
okay, what is? "They got too many trolls."
Haynes was annoyed enough to go for the chill stare and overextended pause, which had made lesser men faint. It bounced off Conway, of course.
"So what else is new?" he said finally. "That son of a bitch Avery has got practically every midget and dwarf on the planet under contract. So what? I already put lawyers on it. Nothing we can do. Antitrust, nothing. It's perfectly legal for those bastards to lock up a whole minority group."
Conway was shaking his head.
"That's not what I mean."
"Okay, what is?"
"Every morning, 434 midgets and dwarves walk into Dream World through the employee entrances for the day shift. Every afternoon this week, 440 walked out. Same for the night shift."
"Huh?"
"They got too many trolls."
Haynes closed his eyes.
"Jesus, a dozen a day, for at least the past week. You see what I mean? I got no idea what it means yet, but whatever the hell they're doing, there's no way it could be innocent. Even before we know what it is, we got them by the balls."
"But what is it? You have any ideas?"
"None I like much. Comic book stuff, some sort of fruitcake illegal immigration scam, maybe, or a new tax ripoff."
"Jesus," Haynes said again. "Could it possibly be some kind of, I don't know, weird child-molesting thing? They kidnap the kids and, like, hypnotize them and then dress them up and make them up like elves and send them out to—" He trailed off, realizing it made no sense, but reluctant to relinquish the fantasy. Avery buggering an elf on the 6 o'clock news.
Conway shook his head. There are never any customers unaccounted for. I check six ways. And it's never elves, leprechauns, or dwarves. Just trolls. At least so far.
Haynes shook his own head.
I could never keep all those little bastards straight. There's two kinds of little people in the world, midgets and dwarves. Midgets are the ones in proportion that look like kids with adult faces. Dwarves are the ones that are built weird. Over there, nice-looking midgets play elves, ugly ones play leprechauns. Nice-looking dwarves are just called dwarves, and ugly ones are trolls. They got too many trolls.
Haynes frowned ferociously.
What the hell does it mean?
He stopped.
You're right, what's the difference? It's got to be wrong, whatever it is. By God, I've got that bastard, Avery. Yes.
How did you happen to notice this?
I didn't. The computer did. I had a general analysis program running on the orbital scans, looking for anomalies, anything we could nail them on. It worked.
Something in Haynes resisted being this happy. He groped for an out. You have this documented? I mean, nailed down?
I can run you the orbital scans, and you can count the trolls yourself.
Our satellites or the government's?
Both. Tamper-proof proof.
There was nothing for it. Haynes felt his face rearranging itself in unaccustomed ways, producing the first grin it had worn since, 5 years earlier, an operative had brought him a photograph of Philip Avery grunting on the toilet.
There is a God, he said. No, Conway said. There isn't.
Well, no, but sometimes you get lucky.
Yes.
Haynes knew his face was going to hurt in the morning, but he didn't care. Well, sometimes that's almost as good. Conway declined to argue the point.
How do you want to hit them with it?
In a leisurely manner, Haynes said. I am in no hurry at all. Avery's mine now, but I still want to know everything before I take him. I want to know exactly what's going on and why and for how long. I want to know about the friggin' Mother Elf, too. In fact, I want to have a long talk with that little bitch.
Hell for?
If she's real, if she's really been there all along, then she knows every single weakness of the place. Maybe some that even Avery doesn't know about. Get me a handle on her.
It'll cost, Conway said. She's way underground. You sure she's worth it?
One time I looked down at my hand and saw a straight flush ace high, Haynes said. Hardly seemed worth it to have the waitress go peek at the other guy's hands. But there was a lot of money on the table, and what did I care if I wasted her time? So I gave her the sign again anyway. We were playing with wild cards, see? And one of those sons of bitches had five deuces. I was so happy later that week I let her go back to being a human being again. Conway nodded.
You can always use more information.
How soon can I talk with the elf? Conway thought a moment.
Soon.
Haynes was so pleased he squirmed in his chair and to hell with his hemorrhoids. No, even more pleased than that. I'm adding a 10% bonus to your fee, he said, not quite believing the words even as he heard them leave his mouth. And another 10 after I see the elf. Now Conway's face wanted to smile too, but he managed to control his. That annoyed Haynes slightly, and in an odd way he welcomed that small annoyance, clung to it as a lifeline back to the disposition and worldview he knew. It made little difference anyway. Once he had brought down Dreamworld once and for all, once he had scattered its rubble and salted its fields and pissed on the graves of its every defender, then he could afford to crush a Conway a week for the pure sport. Damn, now he was happy again. He reminded himself sharply that ultimate victory was impossible. He could conquer Dreamworld, conquer Avery, but the Antichrist himself, Amiga, had escaped him into death. Haynes could, and now would, beat Thomas Amiga, but he could never have the satisfaction of knowing that the son of a bitch knew it. There. That helped.
Well, we've exceeded the hour by a fair bit already, so that's more than a full lid. I'll be back next time with more of the free lunch and more great music. I know I've been spacing these podcasts far too goddamn far apart, and I do apologize, but I really am having trouble getting my novel Orphan Stars out of my skull and onto my laptop, and I figure that's what you'd rather I devote most time to. I will try to return here sooner next time, honest, and I thank you all for being so patient with me for so long. Your podcast donations really are a help. I'm going to leave you with a couple of tracks from a CD that means more to me than I can tell you, called Ordinary Day. It has literally just been released, and I've played it through 5 times already since it arrived in yesterday's mail.
To be completely accurate, it isn't an album, but I'm not quite sure what to call it. I'd call it an EP, but that would be silly, because EP originally meant extended play, a longer-than-usual 45 RPM single. This is a shorter-than-usual album, only 20 minutes long. But I promise you, it packs a lot more emotional wallop and stunning musicianship than a lot of far longer albums. Since I don't know the proper technical term, I've decided to name it a side. That's because when I was coming up, music came on vinyl plates that got about 20 minutes a side. Nearly every Beatles album, for instance, clocks in at 17 to 18 minutes per side. So for me and my generation, a side, 20 minutes or so, is a natural length in which to process groups of songs. The singer, Dori Rubico Leger, is the youngest of the five Rubico girls. My Jeannie was the second in line. The firstborn, Kathleen Rubico, also appears on this side and wrote three of its six tunes. All three were among Jeannie's favorite songs in the universe, and they have never been better performed than here. But two of the songs, equally good, are by Dori herself, including the title tune, and I will start with one of them since it always sends shivers up and down my spine. The cello on this track is by Ian Leger, an ace session cat who happens to be Dori's son. Certain themes seem to be developing here. Here is the final draft version of a song I believe I may have played you a year or so ago as a work in progress, the haunting and beautiful Stranger to Me Now. I guess I'll close the podcast with this song, just as the side does, since it perfectly describes the state of mind I am trying to develop myself these days, the state of being ready for morning to end, not quite knowing how to make that happen.
The song is by Kathleen Rubico, who also plays piano. The side Ordinary Day and several full-length albums by Dory with her former partner Butch McCarthy can be downloaded from www.doryrubico.com/music.html. That's DORIRUBBICCO.com/music.html. Starting tomorrow.
Starting tomorrow, each time my doorbell rings, I won't go tripping over things, hoping it's you. And starting tomorrow, each time I walk upstairs, I won't pretend you're waiting there to hold on to. Oh, my heart has had enough of breaking all night through. There's better things to do by myself or with someone else. I learned to live without you. And starting tomorrow, each time I hear the phone, I won't pretend you're coming home. I'll make it on my own, starting on my own, starting tomorrow. Like
all 92 of its predecessors, Spider on the Web number 93 is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 United States license. In addition, I appeal to you all personally not to use any music heard herein for any commercial purpose without express permission of the artist or artists involved. See you next time.